Right. I'm Bernard Burke from MIT. I'm a physics professor there, and I have a group who do mostly radio astronomy. We have worked with the Very Large Array, the VLA, in New Mexico, and also with the AT here in Australia.
Good evening, Bernard. Welcome to the Space Show.
Well, I'm very pleased to be having a chat with you.
And what brings you here to Melbourne?
Well, there's a conference on gravitational lenses here, and I've been interested in gravitational lenses for the past 15 years, so it was a natural thing to do, to come here and see old friends and talk about what's new.
What's a gravitational lens?
Well, if you have a distant object like a quasar, we see the radio and the light from the quasar travels a long way to get here. And if there happens to be a galaxy or other very massive thing in the way, then the gravitational field of that object actually deflects the light or the radio waves from the quasar, so that, and it can deflect it in such a way that you'll see not one, but two or more images. In fact, the French have a very good term for it. They don't call it a gravitational lens. They call it a gravitational mirage, which is a much better way of describing it because it's a very low-quality lens.
So you see multiple images of the same quasar?
That's right, yes.
How many of these have been discovered?
At the present time, there are approximately 30 that are well-recognized, and another 10 or 15 which people are still arguing about as to whether they really are examples of gravitational lensing or not.
Because quasars aren't all that common, are they?
Well, depends on what you mean by common. That is, there are probably a million or more quasars in the sky, so there are lots of them.
Oh, okay, I had a picture maybe there's only a couple of hundred quasars.
Oh, no, there are at least 10, but probably more than 10 per square degree, and there are 40,000 degrees of sky, so that's 400,000 quasars right there that we know about.
So how do you go about looking for these gravitational lenses?
Well, the particular method we have used is to use a large radio telescope array, and that's why we use the Very Large Array in New Mexico. It's an array of 27 radio telescopes spread across approximately 35 miles of upland plateau. And it is used to make maps of the quasars. In fact, we map all the radio sources, and then we look for characteristic patterns that suggest the sort of multiple images that you might get. Here in Australia, of course, there is the Australia Telescope, which is an array of radio telescopes, and it can be used for the same types of project.
These telescopes are mounted on railway tracks?
Well, they're mounted on a railroad track in order to move, but once you move them into position, you move them off the railroad track and onto hard foundations so they won't wobble around when the wind blows.
Okay, so you're getting quite precise directional data, so you need to have the telescope mounted down.
Oh, yeah, you have to have, everything has to be very stable. And the actual configuration is Y-shaped. There are 9 telescopes along each arm of the Y, and they're connected to a very stable radio transmission system that brings the signals to the central computer where you process them, and eventually develop a map, a radio map of the sky.
And that map is how detailed?
Well, we usually use the array at a frequency that gives us an angular resolution of about 1/5 of an arc second. So we actually get better seeing, if you like to call it that, than most of the telescopes of the world, and in fact quite comparable to the Hubble Space Telescope.
So what things are you talking about here at the conference?
There's a wide variety of subjects. Our own principal paper was measuring the relative time delay in the fluctuating images of quasars in order to, in an indirect kind of way, make a measurement of the scale of the universe, make a measurement of the Hubble constant. But that's only one aspect of it. since the radio waves and the light waves are deflected by the galaxy that is acting as the lens, we can actually study the mass distribution in that galaxy. And as I think nearly everybody who's read the newspaper knows, at the present time it's quite clear that there is a form of matter in the universe called dark matter that we can't see. But even the dark matter has gravitational field. And so we're studying not just the mass contributed by the stars in the galaxy, but by the dark matter as well.
You eventually got evidence for the dark matter, or is it just simply hypothesized that it must be there?
Well, it's hypothesized that it must be there in the sense that we can see the stars, and the stars alone will not account for the kind of distorted images that we see. And it has to be gravity that's doing it, unless there's something very wrong with our theories. And that's always a possibility, but Einstein's general relativity improved on Newton's law of gravity so well that would be have to force pretty hard in order to give it up.
So how does the Australia telescope at Narrabri compare with the VLA, or Very Large Array, in New Mexico?
Well, in one sense it's smaller, in one sense it's larger. That is, the principal telescopes at Narrabri are spread out over a smaller distance than the VLA, but they are tying in radio telescopes from the north at Parkes and all the way south to Tasmania, and connecting them with electronic means so that they can build a much larger radio telescope than the VLA.
Is it actually possible to tie in the VLA with the Narrabri instrument? Although there wouldn't be many times when the same object's in the sky for both of them at the same time.
Well, briefly, things are in the sky at the same time. And the answer is yes, it could be done. That's called very long baseline interferometry. It allows us to get a huge amount of a very high angular resolution instrument, allowing us to see not details of arc seconds, but details of micro arc seconds. And that VLBI technique is one in which the Australians are now participating. The Parkes radio telescope has been used for that class of observation. And NASA has a large radio telescope at Tidbinbilla. Ordinarily, the Tidbinbilla telescope is used for tracking spacecraft, but it's also a powerful way of studying radio stars and quasars with very high angular resolution.
And what's your job at MIT?
Well, I'm the William Burden Professor of Astrophysics, and I spend some of the time teaching, and I run a research group of half a dozen graduate students. I have another colleague, Jacqueline Hewitt, who has another half dozen graduate students, so we have a small research group, and we travel about the world using whatever instrument is best suited to what we want to do at the moment.
Sort of a modern-day nomad.
Oh, that's right, yeah. And I have a number of other interests as well. That is one interest that I have that's very pressing at the moment is I'm interested in how we might detect planets belonging to other stars, to study solar systems of other stars. And that's a subject that genuinely is in its infancy, but in the States we are laying plans to start serious searches for those other planets.
Have we actually discovered any planets around other stars?
Not yet.
So the odd report that's come through that they found something is a little premature?
Well, yes. That is, I think there's a well-known scientific principle that is, the more dramatic the discovery that you're claiming, the stronger the principle of proof that you have to measure up to. And so far, whenever somebody has claimed to find another planet, and that does happen now and then, it usually fades away as the measurements get better. It has always faded away so far.
So what do we need to do to find another planet?
That's a very long story. That is, one can look for the wobble of the star being pulled around by the planet in orbit. That's called precision astrometry. Or you can build an optical interferometer, perhaps something much like the Australia telescope, but on a designed to use optical telescopes and actually try to image, make an image that blocks out the very powerful light from the star and lets you see the tiny little bit of light belonging to the planet next to the star.
So that would require a high resolving power, wouldn't it?
Well, it requires high resolving power, but more than that, the star is a billion times brighter than the planet, and so it requires the ability to subtract away the light from the star with a very great precision before you can see the planet next to it.
A bit like seeing a moth circling around a distant streetlight.
That's it, exactly, only this time it's a very tiny gnat flying around a very bright searchlight.
Okay, what about the proto-planetary disks that the Hubble Space Telescope's been investigating?
Yes, that's has to do with the secondary, the related question of how stars actually are form planets. That is, when a star is formed, very often it has a disk of material around it, and it's from that material that planets would form.
But any chance of there being planets in those disks?
Oh, certainly there are. There's a chance, but the burden of proof is on us to prove that that's so. And that's going to take a while.
Would it be easier to find a planet around another star if the dust and gas has been blown away, or would it be easier before that happens, while it's still got the swirling dust and gas that the Hubble's been observing?
Oh, it'd be very, very much easier to do it after the dust has been blown away. In other words, a mature planet is an easier thing to detect than a planet in the making, which it would be in the midst of that dust cloud.
Rather dangerous to make any predictions, of course, but any estimate as to when we might finally get 100% proof that we're not the only solar system?
I think it's sometime within the next 5 or 10 years we are either going to find another planet, or we're going to discover that planetary systems themselves are very rare. That is, if we don't find planets, that would be an astonishing result also, because we think that planets form rather commonly. And if they don't, then it's back to the drawing board for the theorists to decide, well, how do planets form anyway, and how unique are we in the universe?
Well, thanks for joining us tonight on The Space Show, Bernard, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your stay here in Melbourne.
Well, I'm enjoying myself very much here, and hope I'll be back again soon in the near future.